Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Code 321 podcast. I have Derek Gavelis with me here today. Hello, Derek. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing well.
Thanks for making the trek up to the Great North here.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, no, great. Great to have you. So if you don't mind, do you want to tell the folks just a little bit about kind of how you became involved in the careers you've been involved in and how you made your way to where you are today?
Sure. Post high school, I went away to college for biological sciences at Clarkson University, but I very quickly found that I was spending more time with the outing club, so climbing, skiing, backcountry travel, than necessarily studying calculus or chemistry. And I learned very quickly in college that just because I was good at something in high school didn't necessarily translate into that was going to fit for a college major. And after about 2 years of spinning my wheels, making some really good friends and traveling around the Adirondacks, I switched to Green Mountain College, which had a major in adventure education. So you're looking at more becoming a, you know, a guide or a, you know, adventure educator, a instructor in outdoor pursuits and climbing and skiing and all those good things. And I finished my 4-year degree there and made my way into the outdoor industry. First I started as an outward bound guide out in Minnesota for the Voyager Outward Bound School. That was mostly canoe trips with teenagers and young adults. I spent my winters guiding for ice climbing and mountaineering in Lake Placid, New York. And I spent about 4 or 5 years doing that. And eventually I found a position at Green Mountain College, you know, back where I'd graduated from, helping to manage the student life, had a adventure program. So basically student trip leaders that were under the supervision of a staff member, you know, full-time staff member would be trained to take other students on trips. And there's also with the bachelor program, I was helping instruct an adjunct for those programs. And just over the years, it was just a lot of living in a sleeping bag, not having necessarily the financial security you want, and seeing a lot of amazing parts of the country. But I was looking for something that was a blend of just that, maybe some risk taking, every day, like no 2 days look the same. And eventually I was literally driving down the road on the way to Rutland of all places. And there was this thunderclap moment where I'd done some volunteering as a firefighter in college. And I was like, well, what if you wanted to become a firefighter? Like there's a decent blend of, you know, it's a team sport. There's camaraderie there. There's a physicality there. And of course it's a dangerous, you know, pursuit. You know, you'd be joking yourself if you don't think it's occasionally going to be dangerous. And I was like, yeah, well, this kind of outdoor career is not going the direction I necessarily want. And so I applied for Burlington Fire, and here we are 5 years later.
Yeah, you're doing it, man.
That's trying.
That's exciting. I didn't know you were a Potsdam guy.
Clarkson,
yeah.
The old Potsdam.
Yeah, my sister went to Clarkson, so I spent a little bit of time out there once in a while.
Oh, man. It was my first winter there was so staggering in how cold it could be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Massachusetts, suburban white kid from Massachusetts did not adequately prepare me for the North Country.
Yeah, no, our joke on the helicopter is like when you're going to that area of New York, you basically fly to Lake Ontario, make a left. Like fly till you see the border and then make a left. And it's just, it's funny. It is cold up there, but it's a good spot, you know, and like the Adirondacks really are becoming like a mecca for a lot of the outdoor sports.
Yes.
I mean, Lake Placid is like, Kara and I went there for the first time last year and it was like, it really was cool. We went there the same weekend as Ironman, and it's like its own mini little Colorado out there.
Yeah.
You know, they got a lot of outdoor shops and mountain biking and climbing, and it's a cool spot.
It was, I look back very fondly on my time living in the Adirondacks.
Yeah. And it's playing. It's entertaining too. Cause like we've talked about this before. We're seeing all these like non-traditional fire recruits coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle and I talked a little bit about this is, you know, back in the day, you know, 15, 20 years ago, they saw people who came out of high school, wanted a blue collar job. They tested, took the civil service, and they became a firefighter for 25 years, retired with their pension, bought a 2-bedroom, you know, 2-bath house. And that was that. And now we're seeing, I mean, like you said, we're seeing, you know, D1 ski racers. We're seeing like 40-year-old, you know, military people. We're seeing, you know, people like you have been out and about and done other careers and then come to the fire service. So it's kind of fascinating for that shift to happen.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, obviously it took me longer to get from point A to point B where I'm at now, but on honest reflection, I think that journey made me better at the role I'm in now, both in terms of just learning myself, learning my limits, the physicality aspect of, you know, one of my favorite parts of being an outdoor educator is, you know, the woods are very equalizing. We're all cold. We're all tired. We're all hungry.
Yeah.
And it affects us all the same, you know, so you have nothing but kind of your own grit and your own skills and ability. And I learned so much through those experiences that I think have set me up for success now.
Yeah. I remember like one time, a long time ago, you and I were sitting at the kitchen table at one of the firehouses, probably station two. And we were just talking about like just life stories. Cause it's just, you know, that's how we are. And
sure.
I remember one time you told me the story about driving a van full of kids down the wrong road with a canoe trailer.
Oh my God.
And having a hard time backing it up and just how difficult that was and how long it took. And one of the things I keep thinking about is, like you said, stories like that just like accentuate how those life experiences, if you can make it through an experience like that and not lose your cool and like, you know, blow your top off at a bunch of kids, like then later when you're in the fire department, you know, and you need to position the aerial and it's difficult for you, like you have that life experience to pull from. You're not some 19-year-old kid that's never had a challenge in their life, you know.
I'll tell you, trying to back up a canoe trailer in a 15-passenger van with like 8 teenagers screaming and laughing at you, and it's like, you know, it's a crummy single axle canoe trailer, so you hit one pothole, now the canoe trailer is facing the wrong direction, so you back up 2 feet, pull forward 5 feet, get the canoe kit trailer straight, and it's like, oh man, if you could figure that out, not explode.
Yeah, right. It's like a Family Guy where he's putting the boat in the water, for sure.
Oh man.
But it's cool. It's cool to like have those experiences and have a little background. And, you know, with the new style recruit academy that Kyle and I were doing when I was over there,
it
really allows space for those, like, you know, servant leaders, those unofficial leaders, to kind of rear their head and help with it, because you have people from all different, you know, levels of experience. One of the things Kyle mentioned in our last podcast was, you know, being on the hiring committee, they have, you know, they ask people, you know, talk to us about a stressful situation. And some people are like, oh, I was 5 minutes late to school one day. And that's the most stressful thing they can think of. And other people are like, yeah, you know, I was like, you know, they left me behind on a mountaintop and like whatever. And so it's cool to watch that blend of recruits kind of find their way. And people like you are a great example of like the non-traditional, not right out of high school, and really bring a huge asset to the job.
Yeah. And also, you know, not to discount some of the younger folk coming to the job. And I try to be very honest with some of the young guys, you know, and young, I'm 37, you know, I'm talking about some of the guys who are, heck, not even 21 years old.
Yeah.
And just thinking where I was when I was 20, 21, I couldn't have done this job at that age, and I'm good on them for being able to perform and do the job at their age. You know, it speaks to their character. But it's interesting. And I think as an institution, certainly stronger for the blend, you know, the mix of people, the mix of experiences.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. I was thinking about this the other day. I was talking to my wife about how, like, you know, being assigned to the ambulance downtown and just being like, just having some drunken person screaming in your face, just screaming at you in a tight metal box, that gave me working through those things every night for a few years in a row, gave me the ability to learn how to control my own emotions. And so then when I have my daughter, you know, and she's having a rough night and she just is just fighting it, like I have that place to pull from, like I know what my body does under stress and I know how to manage that. And so you've done a lot of these like outdoor adventure sports. And can you talk a little bit about like, you know, how maybe some of those experience shaped your ability to like compartmentalize your thought process and be productive in times when you're like heightened and stressed?
Sure. And it's actually funny, you know, this kind of came up just the other day, you know, reflecting on my own interview process to get the job. We're just about to ramp up a hiring committee process in just a few weeks here. And one of the questions, obviously, during my interview was, how do you handle stress? Like, what's a moment you had a really stressful situation? And the example I used was, you know, there have been times ice climbing is kind of more inherently dangerous. I'm talking about like lead climbing, not just top roping, for anybody in the audience who knows. You know, the ropes trailing down below you to a belay, and you're climbing up the ice, and it's a fickle medium. And the rule is basically you cannot fall, you know, that you're covered, your crampons, your ice tools, you're covered in pointy bits that just want to snag the ice and snap your leg or spear you. And there's times where you get scared, you know, like truly, you know, you're more fatigued than you planned on. The ice was steeper, or it's colder than you thought. So you're desperately trying to get purchase points in it. And I joked with some friends of mine that for me, I had this kind of, I called it the voice, like kind of in the back of my head, where it was like, you're getting amped up, you're getting scared, you're getting pumped out, you're shaking in your boots, you know, 20 below zero, and you're dumping sweat because you're so scared. And a fall could have significant real world consequences in terms of, you know, permanent injury or death. And that voice just kind of comes from the back of your head. And it's like, hey, you're going to get hurt. Take a deep breath. Place a piece of protection if you can, or climb to a protected stance. Focus on what you're doing. Keep moving. And I always, and to this day, still climbing, you know, that voice, it's just, I don't know, some deep part of the brain that just takes a high stress situation and focuses it, because I've seen similar things happen in my own brain on high stress medical calls, where I remember very vividly the first time I did CPR as a volunteer. And it was just, okay, the first couple of compressions were gross, feeling the bits of the cartilage breaking up. I was like, you're supposed to do compressions, bud. Just keep doing compressions. Just focus on that for now. And it's just that kind of whatever part of my brain chemistry that calls me to outdoor sports just is, allows that compartmentalization. And during that interview, they're, you know, just going on and on about this climbing and being scared, and then this voice, and seeing some of the folks, you know, on the hiring board kind of nodding along, talking about just being objectively terrified and just stomping it down, putting it in a little box. Like, yep, I'm terrified. We can't deal with that emotion right now because there's more pressing concerns of survival. Let's get to a safe stance and then safely decompress that box at another time.
Yeah. And I think like you said, having those mechanisms to know like how and when you're going to be able to like off gas some of that stress. We talk a lot about, like, you know, there's an old like Navy SEAL saying that people use a lot. That's like, look around, take a breath, make a call, which is just about regulating yourself. Mm. It's like, get in touch with where you are in space and time, like control your breathing, because that's connected to like your entire body and your mind.
Yeah.
And then make a decision, you know, and we deal with that all the time in the fire service. And Nate Perkins, one of the Burlington guys that was my officer for a while there, one of the things he always said that I really liked is, you know, we talk about, you know, going in these fires and how it can be inherently dangerous and unsafe and, you know, two in, two out and all these other things that we talk about in the fire service. And he always says, you know, one of your best assets to safety is being really good at your job and being effective. Like if you go out and you stretch a hose line effectively, you get water on the seat of the fire, you extinguish a problem, and then you get out of the building after your search is complete, that's a mechanism of safety. Because if you make mistakes with your hose line stretch and you can't get water and the fire's growing and the smoke's banking down and now you're looking for victims, but you don't have adequate water, like all of those compounding factors lead you into being unsafe. Whereas, you know, I can imagine with, you know, being a climber, you know, just trusting yourself that you have prepared yourself adequately to the point that you're going to be successful at the task you put yourself in front of doing.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned that, because when I was a climbing guide, a big thing I would always mention to, especially first time clients or clients I'd had over the years that are going from, say, you know, being top roped by myself or whatnot, you know, maybe going into multi-pitch climbing and now they're looking to get into lead climbing themselves, you know, you are your own first piece of protection. And for folks who maybe not are super savvy with climbing or whatnot, when climbers talk about protection, you know, if it's, you know, rock, typically it's things you slot into the cracks to basically catch the rope between yourself and the belayer and keep you from plummeting to your death. So to, you know, on ice, you have little screws that thread into the ice. Those are your pieces of protection. And your physicality, your physical strength, your ability to stay calm, your ability to move efficiently and smoothly, you are your own first piece of protection. And, you know, there's, you know, in the world of, say, you know, mountaineering, you know, so snow climbing, you know, you have your crampons and you have your big, you know, mountaineering axe. And there's all sorts of different footworking techniques and mountaineering axe techniques to climbing different pitches and, you know, steepness of snow slopes. But it was the same thing. You know, we go through this whole long lesson of what do you do if you fall on snow and how you use your mountaineering axe to self-arrest, how to slow yourself down and catch yourself from plummeting. And I was always trying to be very, very intentional with my students. The best way to catch yourself from that fall is to prevent it from happening.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's really fascinating. I keep drawing parallels in my head to like the idea of these weather windows, because something that we deal with a lot in, you know, in flight medicine is we can't do much if we're in the air and we get caught in a storm.
Right.
But what we can do is we can pore over the maps. We can pore over the weather. And there's kind of like a joke, especially in New England, about like, oh, there's like one little wisp of cloud in the sky. The helicopter's not flying. I saw one snowflake. Like, you know, and we do fly like IFR instrument flight rules where we can go in and out of the clouds depending on the temperature. But, you know, we do a lot of looking at the weather. Every time a call comes in before we accept it, you know, we take anywhere from a few minutes to, you know, as long as it takes for the pilot and the crew to take a look at what's going on with the weather. Because, you know, when you're, you know, flying 160 knots an hour in the air and all of a sudden a snow squall moves in and you lose your visibility and the rotor blades freeze up, that's a lot harder to fix than seeing a snow squall on the map and saying, let's go by ground. You know, and I think, you know, I hear a lot about these climbers and I love climbing films. I watch all kinds of climbing films everywhere I can find them. And one of the things I always talk about is like how intense these weather window discussions are about, like, they're looking for months and months to try to plan these trips. And then there was one I watched and the guy goes down to Patagonia and he's there for 3 months waiting for a weather window. He literally lives in this guy's house. Every morning he wakes up, he checks the weather. Nope, not today. And he goes and has his tea and
carries on.
Yeah, and shears the sheep. And then the next day he wakes up and finally that one day, they're like, hey, you have 2 days of sunny weather. And every once in a while, they make the call, they get halfway up and it's not sunny.
Yeah.
You know, and like just having that mentality to say, this is my best shot, but like pulling from your experience, you know, and I got to imagine there's times when you're climbing and you're like, I really want to summit this mountain.
Yep.
And you have to be able to say, you know what? It's not going to happen today.
Yep.
It's not a good choice, you know? And I think that parallels to the fire service. There's times where it's like, I really want to go in and search that room. And you look at it and you're like, I'm just not going to happen right now. Like, we got to do some things first. We got to wait it out. We got to get some water on it, you know? And have you experienced that yourself? You know, like coming to terms with weighing risk versus benefit, and how does an outdoorsman approach that?
I think an important part of it, and mind you, this is I have the convenience of hindsight, right? And I think I have the convenience of being a little older and now having a family and being married. Certainly when you're younger, there's this kind of machismo aspect of, I want to be the best I can. Yeah. I want to get to the top. I want to climb every mountain. I want to conquer the world. And there's a certain degree of growing up you have to have. You know, my first few seasons climbing, especially on ice, I spent a good chunk of time in Colorado, teaching out in Colorado for an academic internship, the end of my college years. And sunny Colorado, right? It made for great climbing, great skiing. And I got overconfident. I was climbing way above my ability, just because conditions were so favorable for it. And that next winter, I came back to the Adirondacks and I got my butt handed to me up and down the park. Like, I came and I was like, oh, I'm a strong ice climber. I can climb any climb in the park. I was like, there's no ice. I can't climb it. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, it got to the point where I was hanging out with some friends of mine and I was joking. I was like, I'm having a vision quest every single time I tie into a rope. Like, I go up on that ice, I get in way above my head And sometimes psychologically, I don't come back the same. Like it, yeah. I got so scared and, you know, knock on wood, I never got seriously injured. But eventually just, you kind of have to sit there and look at yourself like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like this is, you're either going to be, you know, a bold climber or you're going to be an old climber. And certainly there's a place to be bold, but you also have to have some degree of humbleness there. And, you know, there are a lot of outdoor institutions. Like I mentioned, the one I work for, Outward Bound. And part of that is just this idea of how can you be confident in your abilities, but also like accurately self-assessed, like what can and cannot you do? And there have been times in the mountains where you start up and like you said, the weather starts to get fickle and you're like, well, maybe we'll just try a little further. We'll try a little further and try a little further. And as you build experience, kind of that little nagging itch in the back of your head, you have to kind of listen to that of like, hey, maybe just it'd be real nice to be able to be still alive and talking about how bad that weather is at a bar, having a beer with your friend instead of frozen to death at the top of this thing. And how fortunate I have been that, you know, I'm still here, still able to climb, still have my faculties and all 10 fingers and toes. I've had, you know, distal frostbite a couple of times, but haven't lost anything yet. And just building, I think you can only build that lens through experience and mentorship.
Yeah. And I think just the wisdom that comes with experience and, you know, like you said, the mentorship. I mean, you hear these stories about these great summits, you know, and what you don't realize is that it's quite a process to do that. I mean, it's not like they pick up their backpack from the airport baggage claim and they go to Everest and climb it. You know, there was one I just listened to a podcast recently about a team climbing, I think in South America in the Andes, and they went down and they spent like 2 months just as a team, the four of them, just being around each other, getting to know each other. And there are times where, you know, they'd say, hey, we're going to go to camp two. And someone's like, I don't really think that's a great idea. And they go, okay, all right, let's look at the map. Let's come up with the plan. You know, and having that discipline to, you know, win, you know, the tortoise winning the race rather than the hare just trying to sprint to the point where you put your, you know, you aren't successful. And I think there's a lot to be said for that in emergency services too. Mm-hmm. The old adage, which I'm sure you've heard, is like, you know, fresh paramedics out of school, you know, it's like just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something every time.
Right.
I had an old trick I used to do on the ambulance when I was working 911, where if someone needed a cardioversion, you know, the first thing I would do would be put them on some oxygen while I'm mixing up my meds.
Yep.
Because, you know, obviously hypoxia is one of the first causes of arrhythmias. And half the time, the arrhythmia would go away once you oxygenate them. And it's like, people are like, oh man, why did you do that? Why didn't you just give like the adenosine? It's like, because it's so low risk. And I've done this enough to know that it's not going to harm them. It might have an impact. And now we're out of the woods. Like just that, like taking a second, it's so tempting just to drop that magic elixir and fire it in there and fix it. But then if you miss something and it's not actually what's going on, you just made things 10 times worse.
Right. It's so funny you mentioned that, just the idea of sometimes less can be more. And sometimes if you can do the small tasks, the simple tasks really, really well, then over time, you know, the bigger picture becomes so much easier. You know, you can, you know, mess yourself up. Say you don't, you know, don't tie into the rope correctly, or you don't fasten your harness correctly. And you can do it thousands and thousands of times, but you miss it. You do it wrong the one time, and then real world consequences there. And when you're with, especially as an instructor with students, or you're with someone new in the mountains, and you need to have that confidence in each other's ability. And you only get that through that repetition of like, okay, well, they can tie and dress their figure eight knot on their harness correctly. So at least we have that, like we have a foundation to build off of that trust.
Yeah. I took a climbing trip up in Acadia, and I was just up there for just a solo trip. And I saw like this mountain guide service, and I was like, oh, I'll just hit these guys up and see whatever. And they had like some private climbing tours, and I was like, cool. So I went out with this guy, and it was just me and this other guy, super squared away climber. And it was wild because, you know, I'm not like a crazy climber, and Acadia is not that hard. Like there's nothing too crazy there, so I wasn't that worried about it. But it was just him and I, and we were doing multi-pitch sport climbing. And so
that's awesome.
I would lead and then he would lead. And as I was doing it, I was like, does this guy want to like spend some more time with me to like make sure that I'm rigging his belay line properly? Cause like we just did it. He like, and I talked to him afterwards. Cause when you're at the top, you just kind of eat your lunch and hang out. Cause that's like the culture of the outdoors world.
Yeah.
And, he's like, no, man, like it looks like I'm laid back, but everything you're doing, I'm watching.
Right.
I'm watching how you put your harness on. I'm watching how you rig the line. I'm paying, like, I can climb and watch you. Like, he's like, it's not like I just was like blissfully ignorant. And I was like, man, that's so fascinating because I was so task saturated that I was focused on my, like, I wasn't worried about what he was doing. But like you said, I mean, these adventure things, you're relying on each other, you know, you're relying on yourself, you know, and trying to have that culture where you're able to take a step back. And some days maybe you're just not in the right headspace to make that climb. And you got to be like honest with yourself. Like, I really want to do this, but maybe it's just not today.
100%. And I've climbed with a lot of folks and sometimes you get to the base of a climb, you look at it and you just get bad juju. And it's like, do you want this lead? No. Why don't you take it? Yeah. Well, I don't want it either. Want to go back to the parking lot, have a beer? All right, yeah. Let's go back to the parking lot, have a beer. You know, and some days it just is what it is. You know, now certainly when I was guiding, I was like, all right, well, somebody paid to be here, so it doesn't matter. But, and there's strategy there too, of you're always operating well within your, you call it scope of practice, your physical ability to not fall, you know, and, you know, or not put yourself in harm's way because you were responsible for a client.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I remember I was climbing just in Bolton with one of my buddies who's from like mountain warfare. So he's very like military style, which is a little different than what I've learned through the fire service and through like traditional rock climbing. And I remember we were doing some sport climbing and I was belaying him from the bottom and he was climbing up. And I noticed that he took like an extra long distance between the two anchors and he was getting ready to hook into the next one. And I was like, ooh. I was like doing the math in my head. I'm looking at where he is, where his like next hooked anchor is, and then where the ground is. I'm like, that seems like that's wider than I'd like it to be.
This math ain't mathing.
Like when I climb, I always think about like how far would I comfortably fall without like snapping my spine in half? And if I'm like looking down, I'm like, I don't want to fall that far. I put an anchor in. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and, he was doing that and I was like trying to think because I didn't want to distract him because he looked like he was getting fatigued, but I also didn't know if he realized how far away the anchor was. So I like in my head recited it like 3 or 4 times to try to get like the timbre of my voice and the tone right. And I was like, hey, just food for thought. And I like tried to say it just like this. You really need to hook that anchor as soon as possible, you know, and like try, cause I didn't want to stress him out, but I didn't want to like not be heard. So I wanted to be very clear. And so he goes to hook the anchor and he's probably a foot too low where he set his feet. And so he's like stretched on his tippy toes.
Man.
And all of a sudden I see like all the muscles in his back and his arm, like starting to stretch and he's starting to move a little. I'm like, oh no. And then again, I'm like, you really need to hook that, like trying to be like, do not. And he didn't hook it and he whipped and it was like, I came off the ground. It was, he didn't hit the ground, but he came down hard enough that I came like probably 5 feet off the ground, just trying to counterbalance him. And he was like upside down in a seat harness. I'm like, okay, so in the future, let's leave a little bit less gap there, you know? And that's a perfect example of like, that can happen to us in emergency medicine, in the fire service. Like you're kind of like in the flow and you're not really paying attention. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're like, how far away am I from the door? This smoke's a lot darker than it was a minute ago.
Yeah. Like that repetition, like your confidence really, really only comes through that repetition of, you know, knowing you're going to do it right because you've mastered that craft, you know, in the world of climbing. For me, you know, people always ask like, well, the ice is so insecure, it's so dangerous. And well, yeah, both of those things are true, but over a certain time you learn this, like when you swing the ice tool and it hits the ice and the pick buries itself in, you get this kind of tactile feel through the ice tool. Like you can feel when the placement's good. And then when the pick hits the ice, it creates this kind of like hollow, like thunk sound. And you can hear when a placement's good, and that comes from experience, right? And so it becomes no longer even a guessing game. It's just like, nope, I know I can hang a car off that ice tool right now because my experience has taught me that.
Yeah, I watched a documentary on a climber who actually ended up dying later, because any serious climber that climbs long enough usually is put in a pretty significant situation. But he was ice climbing, and they asked him exactly what you just said. They said, like, how do you know about this, and how do you do it with all these tools? And he was like, they're not tools. They're part of my body. Like, right. When I'm climbing and I have my, you know, my ice picks and all this stuff, like, it's my body. Like, I feel like I'm holding onto it with my fingertips. And this particular climber does like multi-surface climbing, where he climbs a little bit on the ice, and then he puts his axes in his backpack or whatever, and then climbs on the rock and then goes back to the ice or whatever. And I thought that was really interesting how he's like, it's like my hands. Like, I can feel it. I can feel the ice.
Right. Yeah. You become almost like an extension of the body. And it's funny. The first thing that comes to my mind, I'm now assigned to Tower One downtown, and can be an intimidating vehicle to learn to drive. You know, it's the largest truck in the fleet. You have this 8-foot bucket hanging out in front of the truck that has struck a few things throughout the city.
And some things have struck it.
Yeah, yes. That's an important note. That's not always our fault.
That's right.
That's an important note.
Yeah.
And learning to drive it, I've been assigned not quite a year now, and I feel very confident wheeling that truck around the city. And it's almost like I have this sense in my brain of where the geometry of this truck around me exists in kind of three dimensions. And I always, it's so amazing our brain's ability to learn that. You know, it's just this amorphous, like, I know where that bucket is out in front of the truck. I know where the tail swing is going to be behind me just through wheeling it and driving and driving and driving and putting hours into training and trying to be as good as I can, and just how your brain adapts over time to be able to just now this, like, you know, the extension of yourself, you know, moving in three spaces. Certainly the focus I've found, free soloing over the years. I don't typically free solo on rock. Rock climbing is terrifying to me. My brain's broken. I love ice climbing.
Yeah.
Objectively, the more terrifying thing that will kill you probably should be scarier.
Yeah.
But I love free soloing on ice. The world melts away. You are just your set of ice tools, your crampons, the ice, the temperature, the woods, the route. And I've been on a couple of searches when I was a volunteer, you know, looking for a confirmed entrapment, and getting a little disoriented, but just having that, like, okay, focus, think about what you're doing. Where did you come in from? Finding a point, you know, finding a piece of furniture, finding a wall that I was able to reorient myself, stopped and listened for a little while, kind of like slowed my breathing down, found my partner, and we continued searching. And just, it's so interesting to me, the overlap between the focus I found soloing and that focus you can force yourself to have while, you know, searching, you know, in pitch black.
Well, Derek, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show today, and definitely stay safe out there. And I will not be ice climbing. That sounds terrifying to me. I'll go in a burning building any day. Okay. But, you know, ever since, I think it was Corey Souza told me that when you're climbing, if the ice detaches, the wall you're climbing on falls off the mountainside. I just can't get around that.
A friend of mine, he's a good, you know, accomplished rock climber, and he says, guaranteed every year, Derek, your climbs are going to fall down.
Yeah.
Like at least once a year, they're going to disappear. And I'm like, all right, well, fair.
Yeah. Yeah. But, oh, it's so crazy. Well, I appreciate you coming all the way up here, and definitely stay safe out there.
No, thank you for having me. I had a great time.